Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Matthew Isaacs. He doesn't quite have a lengthy academic biography yet, but that is only because he is at the forefront of his scholarly career and is finishing up his dissertation on religion and ethnic conflict in the Department of Politics at Brandeis University. One of my favorite things to do here on our podcast is to give folks who are not out there in the public eye a chance to share some of their research and intellectual insights, because great knowledge comes from all sources. I should note that I, quote, discovered, unquote, Matthew when he approached me to be an external member on his dissertation committee. Thus, it was really Matt who discovered me. I have been duly impressed by his research and have seen him give presentations at conferences, so I knew he would be a fantastic guest talking about a fascinating topic, so here he is. Matt has conducted fieldwork for his project in Northern Ireland and Sri Lanka, and recently returned from that latter country, which I'm sure we'll hear something about. He has also presented at the annual Graduate Student Workshop at the Institute for Religion, Economics, and Society at Chapman University, which is a great resource for budding PhDs and young professors. If you happen to fall into one of those categories, a budding PhD or a young professor, and you are interested in the topic of religion and its intersection with society writ large, we will provide a link to you to check out this wonderful program. And if you attend that workshop, who knows, you might get to be on the podcast. Matthew, welcome to Research on Religion.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Tony.
And welcome back from Sri Lanka. Now, I've never been there, so was it a good experience?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting place. This is my first time there also. It's a very dynamic environment. The first night I got there, the street outside my hotel was shut down for a student protest. About 2 weeks later, they adopted a new constitutional amendment. Every street in Colombo has a skyscraper under construction. It's a fascinating place, but it's really an exciting place to do research.
Other than a student protest, anything interesting happened to you while you're there? Because field work's always filled with fun experiences.
Yeah. This trip, like my other field research trips, it was definitely a mixed bag. Some really excellent things happened, some disappointing or frustrating things happened, and that's just what it is with field research. One of the surprises to me that actually might sound a little silly is I was there for just over a month, and I discovered that Sri Lanka is of any country in the world that might have the most public holidays. I wasn't expecting this at all, but the first weekend I was there was the full moon holiday, which is a Buddhist holiday that they have every month, naturally. And that's a long weekend. And then the week after that was the Sinhalese New Year, which is always sometime in April. And that's about a 10-day long break.
Wow.
And then 2 weeks after that, you've got another full moon holiday. And so, you know, it's wonderful if you're there on vacation, or if you live there and you take the break. But for me, I was really trying to maximize my time there. So having a little bit over 2 weeks of holidays in my 1 month research trip was a little bit frustrating. To be forced to relax is, maybe not the natural state of academics.
Yeah, and then you have to cram all your interviews and things into a very, very small window.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Or more problematic, the National Archives are closed on public holidays. But it was definitely, I mean, it was a very productive trip, very interesting. Sri Lanka has really wonderful food, so that was actually my favorite part of the trip.
You could have went into the National Archives and just hid behind a bookshelf, and when they closed, you could have those 10 days all there locked in. You know, take a few protein bars and you're good to go.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't considered that, but I'll take that into account.
Oh, I'm sure you hadn't considered that. We won't say anything, though. right. Anyways, let's talk about what you're doing in your research here. And you're working on a dissertation in the Department of Politics at Brandeis. Give us the title of that dissertation.
So it's called For God or Country, Explaining the Salience of Religion in Ethnic Conflict.
Okay, so ethnic conflict. Now, how did you stumble upon that? I mean, for some folks out there, we have a number of undergraduates who listen to this program, and they might be thinking about going to graduate school and wondering, well, you know, where do I get a topic and things like this? And you know, I was even wondering the same thing when I was in graduate school. So how did you stumble upon this topic?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. So I remember listening to an episode of this podcast with Larry Yannacone on, and he told this great story about how he went through must have been a half dozen different dissertation topics, and it took years and all this stuff, and he ended up with something really amazing, obviously. And you know, I don't really have a story like that. For me, it was kind of a different pathway. I sort of came into grad school with a pretty clear theoretical interest. I was always sort of interested in how religion operates in ethnic conflict and how the two things relate to each other. And so for me, the trajectory of developing my project was actually just sort of, I didn't change my ideas a lot. I just tried to figure out the right language to articulate those ideas. So it was this sort of process of trial and error of using one word to describe something and nobody understood what I was saying. And so I'd use a different word. And eventually I sort of landed on what I have now. So there's a lot of that went on in my history. I didn't have a lot of different projects, but I did have sort of different ways of describing what I think was sort of the same underlying project. But that being said, I did make one major change, which was that I came into grad school and did study the Middle East. And I mean, as we'll talk about more, I really don't study the Middle East. But I put a lot of time into it, actually. I took 2 years of Arabic, partially as an undergrad. I spent some time in Egypt and in Morocco. And I was just really fascinated with that region and with ethnic and religious conflict in that region. And, you know, unfortunately, there's quite a lot of it there. But what I found as I was putting together my project is that the thing that makes it an attractive region for people interested in that, which is that there are lots of ongoing ethnic conflicts and religious conflicts, actually makes it a really non-ideal place to do research. So, when you're talking about how are you going to have an effective field research trip, how are you going to get access to documents, access to the right people, all of these things, you know, you're going to have a much better time in Belfast or Colombo than in, you know, Aleppo. So I sort of reoriented that way, and, you know, I'm still happy to be able to speak a little bit of Arabic, and it's certainly helpful, but my advice to people going into grad school would be, you know, maintain your interest, your theoretical interest, but have a little bit of flexibility in terms of the specific thing that you might end up studying.
Yeah, that actually is pretty good advice, because sometimes we get so rooted into something, and a lot of times too, that the students want to study something that is currently ongoing, that, oh, there's a lot of ethnic conflict right now in this part of the world, so I'm going to go study that. And possibly by the time you get off the plane, the war might be over and you don't have anything to study anymore. So, you know, rooting things back in history a little bit, which is what you did, not deep, deep, far in history, but such that the, you know, conflicts are more or less over, allows you to basically frame your project without having any surprises at the other end.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, the sort of, you know, we're, as political scientists, we're not frontline journalists. Right. We really, one of the first things that you need to figure out when you're designing your project is it doable?
Yeah. No, doable projects are very good. And you were also one of those guys that in first grade, they went around the room and said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And somebody said astronaut, and somebody else said fireman, and you said, I want to be a scholar of ethnic conflict, combining religion with an interesting theoretical perspective.
Yeah, that's right. That was actually kindergarten.
Kindergarten. You were a young starter, I guess. Okay, well, that's not surprising, because ethnic conflict has actually been a hot topic as of late in political science for at least the last decade, if not a little bit more. So let's talk about that and give us some of the explanations for why ethnic conflict may erupt in some places, and particularly why some folks thought it would or would not have a religious dimension. What's the extant literature out there?
Yeah, so there's a lot of literature out there on this, and what's interesting to me is that actually there's almost a scholarly consensus on what factors will cause conflict between ethnic groups. So sort of basic intuitive things like whether the ethnic group is excluded from politics or is systematically sort of economically disadvantaged, cultural grievances, all of these things that we sort of intuitively see in the headlines as contributing to ethnic conflict. And I should stress that I'm not necessarily talking exclusively about ethnic violence. When we talk about ethnic conflict, we can also mean things like the Catalan secessionist movement, right? This is a movement in Spain to develop an independent state of Catalan. But it's not really a violent movement. There's conflict between ethnic groups without there being violence. And that's another example of something that's sort of pushed on by political exclusion, that sort of thing, or a sense of cultural grievance. And then sort of another one of the key causes of ethnic conflict might be political repression. That's a sort of a fairly straightforward one, although it's an interesting one because it's something that if there's quite a lot of repression, you might not see conflict because people can't really mobilize. It's just a moderate amount of repression that encourages people to mobilize. And then finally, there are some sort of international level factors. If you are an ethnic group in a state right next to a state experiencing a civil war or ethnic conflict, you might be more likely to have that in your state. Mm-hmm. And alternatively, if you are a member of an ethnic group that is persecuted and involved in conflict in another state, whether it's nearby or not, that might diffuse sort of or pass into your state. So the scholarly literature really sort of provides a pretty comprehensive picture of what it is that causes ethnic conflict and really large-scale ethnic war. The problem here, and the thing that I'm really interested in, is that this research doesn't really say when this conflict will be about or involve religion in particular. So one of the sort of straightforward prerequisites you might think would be that there needs to be a religious difference between the groups involved, right? That's true to some extent. It's not necessarily the case. There are definitely religiously infused civil wars that are about things like that are between groups that are sort of secularist versus, let's say, Islamist, right? But in general, a religious boundary is important. But then there's also huge variation even when there is a religious boundary. So I already mentioned there's, sort of ongoing, we all know about ongoing conflicts in the Middle East, ISIS today. This is a case that's very heavily religiously infused because groups like ISIS really make it religiously infused. They talk about religion. But then there are other cases where maybe one group involved in conflict really uses religion for mobilization or has religious goals, and other groups really don't. So some of the cases I look at, and we can talk more about that, in Northern Ireland and Sri Lanka, those are really cases where it's fundamentally unbalanced. One group involved in conflict is not necessarily religiously motivated, but they use the language of religion to get people out into the streets. And other groups really don't. And other sort of unbalanced cases of this type of phenomenon would be Yugoslavia in the 1990s, or sort of ongoing conflict actually in Thailand. And then finally, there are a few cases where of ethnic conflict where there's a religious distinction, but actually religion really isn't involved at all on either side. So I think when people think of the conflict in Cyprus in the 1970s, for example, it's almost always characterized as a conflict between sort of Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots or Turkish nationalists. And people forget that that's also sort of it's also a conflict between Christians and Muslims. But because religion really has no relevance to the conflict, it's not seen as a religious conflict. And you can also sort of make that argument about, for example, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict early on. So in the 1940s, sort of through the 1960s, you have secular Arab nationalists, Nasser, Yasser Arafat, sort of fighting against these sort of secular Zionist leaders in Israel. And although there's a religious distinction between them, and it's definitely important, people aren't really mobilizing using religion until the 1970s. That really starts to change in the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and now you actually see quite a lot of religion on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. So, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting how you see variation across space, but also across time. I mean, I find the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to be rather interesting, because a lot of my students say, well, it's always been Muslims versus Jews. And I go, well, not really. You go back to the 60s and even into the 70s, it was a very secular period of time. So, Matt, you said that religion can vary quite a bit on conflict. Why does that happen?
Like I said, the key question I'm interested in is what explains this variation in the salience of religion and conflict? Why is religion very important in some conflicts, really totally irrelevant to other conflicts, even when there's a religious boundary? And this is really important, actually, because there's all this research that says that when religion is more involved in conflict and more relevant to conflict, it really changes the trajectory of conflict. So ethnic conflict tends to be much more violent when religion is heavily involved. It tends to be longer lasting. All of these sort of, somewhat intuitive qualities of religion that make it really quite problematic when it becomes involved in dynamics of ethnic groups. So it introduces problems of indivisible issues. Whereas maybe ethnic groups can be politically included, they can divide economic resources. Religion is really, it introduces this question of indivisibility. There's a lot of cases of territory that a religious group really considers as sacred homeland, and you can't divide that between two different groups if it's contested. So for all these reasons, religious conflict is, like I said, more violent, longer lasting. It's less likely to be solved through a negotiated settlement. And if it is solved through a negotiated settlement, it's much more likely actually to reoccur. So figuring out actually when religion is involved in conflict is actually really, really important for figuring out how to solve conflict.
Now, you mentioned that stuff on indivisibility. We had Ron Hassner on the show a few years back talk about that. That's one of the things that he brings to the table here. Right. He is one of the scholars that really takes religion seriously as a factor in a lot of these ethnic conflicts. But one of the things we bemoan a little bit here on Research on Religion is that social scientists really ignore religion as a causal factor or some kind of catalyzing factor. Has that been true of the ethnic conflict literature over the past decade or so? It seems like religion would be a natural factor that you would look at in any type of ethnic conflict. So have scholars been doing this?
That's a great question. And the record is sort of mixed. So the religion has definitely become more of an interesting question for people who study this, and there have definitely been developments. But the real issue is that the literature right now tends to define religious conflict according to one of two definitions. So there's the sort of identity-based definition, where conflict is defined as religious whenever there's a religious distinction between the groups. So any of the conflicts I just listed would qualify as religious conflicts, regardless of whether people are talking about religion or regardless of the specific causes of conflict. And that includes cases like Cyprus, for example, where actually religion is really sort of incidental rather than integral to the conflict. So that sort of measurement, that approach, actually introduces all sorts of problems, because on the ground, you might say something is a religious conflict, but people really might not agree with you, and it might have really big implications for how you solve that conflict. The second approach is a sort of issue-based approach, which I think is a little bit more intuitive, defines religious conflict as conflict where the major goals or the goals of major actors involved are religious in nature. So ISIS might be sort of a classic example. The group is ostensibly aiming to establish an Islamic state, or already has, depending on who you ask. And it's fundamentally a conflict about religious goals. So the primary issues at stake are religious. And that's also sort of the approach that maybe Ron Hassner uses, talking about issue indivisibility as a primary driver of religious conflict. The challenge with that is that it's actually, whereas the religious, the identity-based approach is maybe a little bit too broad, it includes a lot of conflicts that aren't really about religion. The issue-based approach, I think, is a little bit too narrow. So there are lots of conflicts where the actors involved, whether we're talking about the state or non-state paramilitary groups or terrorist groups, where they really talk about religion a lot, but religion isn't necessarily their primary issue or motivating force. What they do is they sort of use religious rhetoric to mobilize people. And in fact, actually, the majority of conflicts where religion is involved fall into this middle ground. And that's really what I'm interested in. What explains this sort of this use of religion in this way to mobilize people for conflict?
One of the things that you do that caught my eye and the approach that you like is that you pick up from the religious economy school. Now, how did you pick up on that line of thought? And has it been fairly useful for you in figuring out what this middle ground of using religious rhetoric is?
For me, actually, when I first came across the religious economy approach, it was just a totally natural fit. I found it very intuitive. But I'll say that the literature on ethnic conflict really starts off from actually a very similar sort of foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the literature on that now is, and for a long time really, has been looking at ethnic conflict as an outcome of the rational actions of all entities involved, whether it be, as I said before, states, paramilitary groups, terrorist organizations, or just the people on the ground who support or are victimized by or radically oppose these organizations. And the sort of rational actor approach in general is really dominant in the study of ethnic conflict. But people haven't really looked at it, haven't really applied it to the role of religious groups or organizations in ethnic conflict. So actually, with that as the base, the religious economy school is really a natural fit for studying the role of religion in ethnic conflict.
Well, that is cool. That's one thing I like to hear, being a partisan of that school of thought. So it's always good to hear that. So let's dive now right into your thesis. You have basically a theory that's divided into four segments or four hypotheses. So try to tell me why we see this variation in the salience of religion and ethnic conflict. What's your thesis?
So the basic argument really is that, as you said, drawing on the religious economy approach, the thing I'm looking at is really, are religious leaders within the ethnic group, are they engaging in competition with each other over the market share of religious adherence? So my sort of primary hypothesis is that religion will actually be more salient in conflict when the group's religious economy, and I can explain this in more detail, is fundamentally competitive, and it'll be less salient in ethnic conflict, when the group's religious economy is more monopolistic. And the way I define that is sort of that a competitive religious market within these ethnic boundaries is a religious market composed of multiple religious institutions. So a case I'll talk about in more detail later, I think, is Protestants in Northern Ireland. The comparison between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland is that among Protestants, there are a number of different denominations that are each structurally autonomous. You have the Presbyterian Church of Ireland, the Church of Ireland, the Methodist Church, and then a number of smaller ones. But there's no single overarching hierarchy that either A, distributes resources through those churches, or B, limits the behavior of them in any sort of meaningful way.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they do, following the religious economy approach, they do compete over adherence within Protestantism in Northern Ireland. On the Catholic side, you have basically this sort of one, you know, relatively monolithic Catholic Church that's hierarchical, fairly limiting of the autonomy of local priests, although that also varies a lot, and also distributes resources across the single organization. So those two religious markets are fundamentally different. One of them is competitive, and one of them is basically monopolistic. And the competitive religious market is where you'll see much more salience of religion and ethnic conflict, because the behavior of religious leaders following the religious economy school really pushes them into conflict, but pushes them into politics in general.
Mm-hmm.
So when conflict happens, it's much more likely to be religiously oriented or have some relevance to religion.
So competition matters quite a bit, but you also mentioned something else there when I was listening to you, and that's resources. You know, the churches love their stuff and junk, so tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. So the hypothesis I just sort of described is the sort of primary sort of motivating question, or rather the primary answer in my dissertation. But there are a few other things that fall out of it, right? The story I just sort of told is it does start with, as you said, stuff and junk. So motivating this type of competition is basically very rudimentary concerns over institutional well-being and material resources to run your religious institution. So one of the sort of basic parts of the religious economy school is that these are organizations that just operate like any other sort of civil society organization. They're concerned over maintaining institutional well-being and making sure they can pay their bills. Religious leaders are also, depending on where they stand in the religious economy, they're either employees or they're small business owners. So they're concerned over material resources, and when they lose those resources in a competitive religious economy, they're more likely to engage in the kind of competition that I'm looking at. When they lose those resources in a monopolistic religious economy, the behavior is a little bit different, because at a local level, if they're experiencing resource loss, they might get that through the hierarchy. And even if they don't, they might be limited in their autonomy and their ability to engage in competition with their co-religionists. So the second sort of implication of my approach here is that when religious institutions in a competitive religious economy lose material resources, they're more likely to engage in this kind of competition. And as a result, ethnic conflict involving those involving that ethnic group is more likely to be about religion or be associated with religion in some way. So there are two other sort of implications of my approach. And one of them also follows directly from the religious economy school. And that's that where the group's religious market is restricted by the state, there's also going to be a lot less of this activity. So when there's a competitive religious economy and religious leaders might engage in these types of competitive dynamics, if the state actually restricts the behavior of those leaders, they might start to act just the same way they would in a monopolistic religious economy where their behavior is limited by the structure of the market itself. And third and finally, the extent to which this process sort of spills over into politics and actually really affects the dynamics of ethnic conflict is also going to be linked to the openness of the state's political system, or the what we call political opportunity. So where there's an opening in the ability of civil society actors or political entrepreneurs to actually influence the way the ethnic group's political representatives behave, and political representatives can mean parties, but it can also mean, in the context of ethnic conflict, paramilitary groups, or as I said before, terrorist organizations. When the representation of the group is open for contestation, that's when this dynamic is actually going to really affect things. So looking at variation over time in this behavior in ethnic conflict, in addition to being affected by material resources and state restrictions on religious leaders, it's also really heavily influenced by political opportunity, which can mean a number of things, but it can also mean the actual nature of a state's political institutions, whether it's a democracy or not.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of those things that you mentioned earlier. When you have a very, very, very repressive regime, nobody can do much. But when you start to relax a little bit and start to allow for some liberalization, that opens little pockets for people to start mobilizing, and you need something to mobilize around. Oftentimes it's religion.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So those are good hypotheses. I like the focus on religious competition, and then within the world of religious competition, you have those three other hypotheses that motivate everything. You went out and tested this. You went out and tested it two different ways, actually. You did, as we talked about earlier, some field work out there in Sri Lanka and then also Northern Ireland, but you put this to the statistical test, and this is what you recently presented at Chapman University, the IRIS workshop. Tell us a little bit about how the stats came out.
So you're right. I've used both methods, and I think that's really important when you're studying religion in general. In ethnic conflict, it's really important to have generalizability across a lot of different cases, and that's where stats come in. But it's also, when you're studying religion, it's important to have this, this sort of delicate, very nuts and bolts approach, because stats really focus on the input and the output, but this is a process, and so I think having both of those is really important. So for my statistical analysis, I won't go into the details, because they're definitely extremely boring.
Yeah, don't start doing chi-squared analyses for us on here, because it doesn't translate well to the audio format.
Right, I think that's a different podcast.
Yeah.
But the basic thing I looked at is how many different religious institutions operate within the boundaries of the ethnic group, And if it's more than one, and if there's a sort of, as I said before, a relatively open competitive religious market operating within the boundaries of the ethnic group, then I test to see if that corresponds to the use of religious rhetoric by political actors involved in ethnic conflict representing that group. So basically, do the major paramilitary groups or the major terrorist organizations, do they use religious rhetoric to mobilize that group? And does that correspond to the structure of that group's religious economy? So what I found, well, maybe I should talk a little bit about the measures I used.
Yeah, because this is kind of something that I've always been interested in. You're going to code something as this rebel group, this group uses religious conflict. How do you know that they're, using religious conflict? How do you know that they're using religion? Are they waving a big, huge flag that says, we're all about religion, or is it something more subtle? And where are you getting your data from?
Yeah, so, actually, they often are waving those flags.
No, that helps. That helps a lot.
Yeah. So the data on religious rhetoric is actually something that I spent quite a lot of time coding myself. I think one of the primary challenges to studying this for someone coming from the ethnic conflict perspective is that the data on religion is just very poor. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to get certain kinds of data on religion because sometimes the only way to get it is to go to a religious institution in person and politely ask for it. And when you're talking about cross-national data where you have thousands of data points, you really can't do that. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of finding the best available data or making your own, but you can only do so much of that. So for me, I went through all of the ethnic groups that are religiously distinct in this way that I was talking about before. And I basically looked at all of the organizations that represent them or that claim to represent them. So if a group says, we are the representatives of the Catholic population of Northern Ireland, then they're sort of an ethnic organization representing Catholics. But that's different from saying that they represent Catholics on a religious level. So what I did was after finding a sort of compiling a list of all those organizations, I went through and coded on an annual basis whether they use religion to represent the group or not. And there are a lot of different sort of ways that you can measure this. And I was just sort of primarily interested in public religious rhetoric where they're talking about the group as a religious group. You don't have to be quoting the Bible, but describing Catholics as a religious group in Northern Ireland as opposed to a nationalist group or an ethnic group associated with the Republic of Ireland, something like that. There's a difference there, and that's what I was coding.
So what do you find?
So the findings are actually really fascinating. I found that basically if you divide the groups according to, as I said, the structure of their religious economy, their religious market, these two different kinds of religious markets, these two different groups of different kinds of religious markets, they behave totally differently. So where there's a competitive religious market, changes in the material resources, controlled by religious institutions, changes in state restrictions, and changes in political opportunity really, really dramatically influence whether that group's political representatives are using religious rhetoric in representing the group. So what you get is over time this fascinating relationship where the capacity and incentives for religious leaders to engage in the kind of competition I'm looking at translates really, really well, actually, into the political representation of the group. Mm-hmm. But then that same dynamic really doesn't happen at all, where there's a monopolistic religious market. Those factors actually have very little influence. When there's a decline in material resources, religious leaders in a monopolistic religious market don't really seem to engage in any kind of activism or competition. And as a result, there really is no relationship between material resources controlled by religious institutions and the political representation of the group, whether it's religious or not. And the same is true for the other sort of relationships. In fact, I'm a big fan of charts and graphs. And if you were to graph it out, you get this really strong, just sharp line looking at political opportunity, the more democratic the group country is in a competitive, when the group has a competitive religious market, the more democratic the group's country is, the more there's going to be religious rhetoric. And it's this sharp positive line. And it's beautiful, and that's what you love to see when you're doing that. And when there's for monopolistic groups, though, for groups with monopolistic religious markets, it's just a flat line that indicates that there's actually no religious rhetoric. The group could be in North Korea, or it could be in the United States, and it would have basically the same level of religious rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
So distinction is really interesting, and you know, these things vary over time. The relationship is stronger at certain time periods and things like that. But it's basically it's more or less strong as you can get statistically. Evidence for this general relationship where religious institutions and leaders engage in this kind of competition that affects whether religion is relevant in ethnic conflict or not.
So you said that this varies over time, and what is the bookends of your time frame here?
So I'm looking at this time period from basically my data is from 1970 to I think 2012.
Okay,
and it's not a very theoretically informed time frame. It's just when the data are out there and when it's easier to get information on these organizations.
Yep. And by the way, to everybody out there, you know, dealing with social science, you can have the greatest theories about what eras you should be looking at, but a lot of times you have to take the data that you have. You don't get much of a choice, right? You said, oh, this would be great to take back to 1800, but one, there's data availability on that. And then the other thing is that it probably would take you another 7 years just to code all that data.
Yeah.
And there's two different types of dissertations, finished and unfinished.
Well, and I'll say, I said before that the availability of data can be very limiting. But one of the hardest things when you're studying religion in particular, and I think this is really a challenge in the religious economy approach in general, is that you really just cannot find data on material resources controlled by religious institutions. So what I did was I found sort of the second best. Religious institutions really aren't often compelled to divulge financial information, and they usually choose not to. So what I've done is I included actually a measure of whether the state provides material support to religious institutions and whether that changes over time. So what I actually have findings on are that when the state gives less money to religious institutions, and those religious institutions are in a competitive religious market, they tend to engage in this competition much stronger than they do when they have more funding. So it's a compromise in a way, but it's still a very strong finding in support of my theory.
Yeah, and that, again, goes to the point that you have to go to your analysis with the data you're given. It's, you go to war with the army that you're given, you go to your analysis with the data that you are given. And it sets up a very strong circumstantial case that says, okay, something is going on here. We're seeing some pretty clear lines. And then what you do, which I absolutely love, you just don't stop with the statistical analysis and say that this is done. You say, let's go look at the nuts and bolts of this. Let's go to Sri Lanka and let's go to Ireland to do that. Now that's where I want to turn our attention to, because there's some really interesting causal dynamics that you can see on the ground there. Let me first start off, though, by asking, why Ireland and Sri Lanka?
that's a great question. You know, obviously they're very different countries. Like I said, they're on totally different sides of the world. They have very different histories. They have different ethnic dynamics. They have different religious groups. But they have a lot in common that's actually that makes them really perfect for this kind of analysis. So both of these countries, both Northern Ireland and Sri Lanka, experience ethnic conflict basically in the second half of the 20th century. So in Northern Ireland, the Troubles, as the conflict is referred to, from sort of 1968 to 1998, sort of a long-term, actually low-intensity ethnic conflict. It's not really a full-blown civil war, but it's definitely, it's a major ethnic conflict. There's about between, I think it's about 3,500 deaths over this period because of the conflict. In Sri Lanka, there's actually, the time period is actually very similar. So the Sri Lankan Civil War is from 1983 to 2009. So it's a little bit shorter, but it's also about 10, 15 years later. But it's a different kind of conflict. It's much more of a very large scale Civil War. Actually, estimates of the number of casualties they vary quite a lot, and it's still sort of a little bit up in the air, but it's the middle ground estimates put it at around 60 to 70,000 people killed in that Civil War. So in that sense, they're very different places. I think the total number of people killed in the Troubles in Northern Ireland might be a single night of rioting in Colombo during the Sri Lankan Civil War. But they both share this sort of time period. They both share this general process of escalation around the same time, really outright conflict around the same time. And they both end, you know, more or less within the same, within about a decade. But both countries also have this really interesting dynamic where, as I said before, one group involved in the conflict really actually uses religion quite a lot for mobilization. There's a lot of religious rhetoric in representing one of the groups, but then the other group actually has basically no religion involved in conflict, even though the groups in both countries differ on religious grounds. So in Northern Ireland, you have the Protestants, which are the majority group, and the Catholics, which are the minority. Over time, the Protestant paramilitary groups and Protestant political organizations really start using quite a lot of religious rhetoric in the run-up to the conflict and during the early stages of it. But on the Catholic side, there's almost no religious rhetoric involved. The major Catholic paramilitary and political organizations are really oriented around emphasizing nationalist sort of secular rhetoric. Their primary goals are to take Northern Ireland and take it away from the UK and add it into the Republic of Ireland. And they aren't really doing that on religious grounds. It's a secular secessionist movement, and it's really motivated by, like I said, nationalist principles, sometimes socialist principles that get involved during the Cold War. But so there's this huge differentiation on both sides. And you see the same exact thing in Sri Lanka. So the majority group in Sri Lanka, as I said before, are the Sinhalese, and they are overwhelmingly 90%+ Buddhist. But then the minority group involved in the Civil War is the Tamils, and they're almost entirely Hindu. So there's this religious distinction there, but just as in Northern Ireland, among the Sinhalese, Buddhist rhetoric is actually a major component of the political mobilization process during the Civil War, during and prior to the Civil War. But for the Tamils, Hinduism really does not serve as a basis for mobilization. The major Tamil paramilitary groups, like the Tamil Tigers, the LTTE, they adopt this very secular nationalist, secessionist sort of language oriented around the creation of a secular Tamil state in the northern part of Sri Lanka. That's their primary goal. And they use, again, they actually use a lot of sort of socialist rhetoric, but they really never talk about religion. So these groups actually, in this way, for what I'm interested in, are actually an ideal basis for, excuse me, for comparison. So they might seem like really, you know, vastly different countries, but they're actually really perfect.
Have you gotten any blowback on that comparison? Because I remember writing an article at one point in time with another colleague of mine on a comparison of Mexico and Iran, and one of the reviews that came back from a journal says, you can't compare those two countries, they're completely different. Have you received any blowback on that, saying Ireland or Northern Ireland and Sri Lanka, that what a foolish comparison, you foolish young man?
Absolutely. I mean, they're very different countries. Although I should have mentioned, actually, one of my favorite similarities between them is that they're both islands.
Oh, well, that's
very important for politics.
Yes, yeah, that makes sense. But no, I mean, has there been any pushback from the profession at large saying you can't make those apples and oranges comparisons?
Absolutely. I mean, so one of the big things that really distinguishes them, I think, is actually a real strength of the analysis, which is that you're talking about two ethnic conflicts with four different religious groups that are all effectively different religions, right? You've got so Protestants and Catholics. Yes, they're both forms of Christianity, but they're definitely different religious traditions, and they're very importantly different in this context. And then you've got Buddhists and Hindus. So you've got really four different religions, and the one might think that actually makes it a poor case for comparison. But I actually think that's a strength of this, because there's a lot of criticism in the study of religion and the social sciences of being sort of focused on one particular tradition or non-generalizable. And especially when you look at the literature on the role of religion in ethnic conflict, a lot of analyses might focus only on, for example, Islam. And the big question is a theory that explains how Islam functions in civil war, is that generalizable to Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism? So having actually an analysis that looks at the dynamics of multiple different religious traditions actually really kind of confronts that and says, yeah, these are dynamics that operate in religion in general, and they're not really particular to, say, Protestantism. And that's especially important because involving Buddhism in this analysis, I think, is a very jarring thing to some people, because I think Buddhism is sometimes seen as a very nonviolent religion. It couldn't possibly have anything to do with the civil war ever. And, you know, the truth is that the majority of Buddhists are, just like the majority of any other religion, are peaceful, you know, good people with good intentions. Mm-hmm. But it's true that also, just like most other religions, there is a very small minority who take advantage. And the point of including it in an analysis like this is to show that it's not necessarily exceptional in that way.
Yeah. Now, peoples is peoples all around the world. So I like the generalizability aspect of yourself. And you gave a very good answer to the apples and oranges question that I have frequently gotten. And I've always wanted to say that people who tell me, well, you can't compare apples and oranges in this study of Mexico and Iran or Northern Ireland, Sri Lanka. I just want to fire back, well, then you just must be paralyzed in the produce section at the grocery store. I don't know. But so given that, and I think it's a brilliant comparison, and I just love it how you methodologically set it up. Give us what you have found in your field work. Let's go ahead and start with Ireland, because I'm of Irish heritage, and that's the first place you visited. So what is going on there that illustrates your theory?
The story in Northern Ireland is really, really fascinating. So like I said, the outright, or you could say the sort of nominal beginning of the conflict there is in 1968. And what happens is there's a protest march in the city of Derry, which is in Northern Ireland, but it's right on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And this protest march gets shut down by the police, and in response there's quite a bit of rioting, and there are a few people killed, and it really sparks what turns into this big 30-year-long intermittent period of ethnic conflict. But before that, and this is true of every ethnic conflict, even though it started in 1968, the dynamics that caused it really go on for decades before. So what happens in terms of religion is that actually, and I'll start from the beginning, and it might seem a little bit disjointed, but to me, actually, one of the primary causes of the fact that there's far more religion on the Protestant side than there is on the Catholic side is it has to do with something that happens in World War II. And it's a really fascinating story, and I was really, like, totally thrilled when I found this doing my research. So in 1941, Belfast, the capital of Northern Ireland, actually gets bombed by the Germans. And it's called the Belfast Blitz. I think something around 1,000 people died, and most of the inner city of Belfast like gets totally destroyed by this bombing campaign. And so I mentioned before that one of the factors that in my theory that pushes religious institutions to engage in this kind of competition is material resource shortages and the inability to sort of operate their institutions. So the clearest impact of this Belfast Blitz is that it actually destroys quite a lot of churches in Belfast, which is a problem if you are trying to run a church.
Yeah, you need space.
To say the least, yeah. So a huge number of churches get destroyed in this bombing, but also a huge number of houses get destroyed in the city. And this is, like I said, this is in 1941, and they really don't make a lot of moves to fix it until 1945, for obvious reasons. But beginning in 1945, there's this huge move to the suburbs. And it's this beginning of this really rapid suburbanization of Belfast. And the population, I think some hundreds of thousands of people basically relocate to these newly constructed housing estates that are funded by the Northern Ireland government or funded indirectly through the UK government. And So the UK is putting up the money for these houses, but they don't put up any money for anything else in these neighborhoods. It's a very, you know, if you're interested in this sort of thing, it's definitely a very 1950s urban renewal style thing where basically the government says, okay, we'll help you build these neighborhoods, you know, and worry about everything else yourself. What happens is that the churches, who which really, really rely on, you know, people being able to sometimes walk or very briefly drive to the nearest church, they find themselves stranded in the city. And they actually, first they put a lot of money into rebuilding these church facilities that are destroyed in the city. And just as they've spent almost all their savings on this, all the people move out of the city. So the three major denominations of Protestants in Northern Ireland, the Presbyterians, the Church of Ireland, and the Methodist Church, they all start taking on tons and tons of debt so that they can build new church facilities in these suburbs. It's this really interesting dynamic where population moves and the churches have to follow, but they don't have the resources to do it. So it creates this huge resource problem for the churches. And the 1950s in Belfast are this time period where it's every single day in the newspaper you hear about, you know, this church is in so much debt and this church is doing this to try to overcome their debt. And it's this really, you know, if you're interested in the religious economy approach, it's really very clearly this open, competitive religious market where these churches are really struggling to survive. And they're doing all sorts of the things that economists predict they would do to try and survive. They start having fundraising drives, and it doesn't work as well as they would like. So then they start doing things like getting into new media of the time. So they start holding film classes to do to produce promotional films for the churches, and they start doing all these outreach initiatives. And at one point, someone I think in the Methodist Church says, "Well, what if we paint our churches a different color? People might be more likely to stop on the road and go to church there." And that's when, just as you might predict, the competition between them really starts to heat up. And someone in the Church of Ireland says, like, "Well, you know, look at what the Presbyterian Church is doing. Like, we can do better than that, and we want to get all the people from the Presbyterian Church in our church." This type of competition is just everywhere at the time. And there's actually one really fascinating story is that in the immediate sort of post-war period in Belfast, like I said, the downtown is really just really destroyed. And there's this one square in it, sort of near the City Hall in Belfast that's this bombed out square that starts to be called Blitz Square. And it doesn't get redeveloped actually until I think the 1980s, but it's this big empty square full of like ruins and bombed out buildings, and it starts to become sort of like a public park. And within Blitz Square, that's the place that you go to see street preachers throughout the 1950s. And it's literally like as literally as you can get. It's an open religious market of individual preachers trying to sort of make their mark. On these adherents in Northern Ireland who are sort of without a church because of this disequilibrium in the religious market. So these dynamics go on throughout the 50s and 60s, and you start seeing the entrance of like new religious actors into the market, and particularly in 1951 is the founding of the Free Presbyterian Church by Ian Paisley, who later becomes, if anyone knows about Ian Paisley, becomes a big political figure in Northern Ireland. But in 1951, he's just this evangelical preacher. And because of this disequilibrium in the market, he's able to really actually get a foothold, and he establishes this church in 1951, and it starts to grow really rapidly. So the dynamics throughout this period are competition, but it's not really, there's no politics yet. And in order for the political part of it to come in, just as I sort of expect in my theory, there needs to be this opening of political opportunity. And that starts coming in the 1960s. The dominant political party at the time, the Unionist Party, the dominant political party for Protestants, I should say, because there's sort of a bifurcated electoral market in Northern Ireland. So Protestants vote for Protestant parties and Catholics vote for Catholic parties. But at the time, the the dominant Protestant party is called the Unionist Party. And in 1963, they elect this leader who is Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, because it's the largest party, named Terence O'Neill. And O'Neill basically, he's a fascinating character, but he comes to power at this time when tensions between Protestants and Catholics are really heating up. And in fact, a lot of that has to do with this housing shortage in the 1950s. But he starts doing, following these policies that are aimed at alleviating tensions. He starts to argue that, well, no, we shouldn't join the Republic of Ireland. We should be part of the Union, not because of our British heritage or because it's a Protestant country, but because of the economic advantages of the Union. I mean, he tries to do all these things that, try to build bridges between the communities. And because of that, he basically develops all this opposition within the Protestant community. And seeing the decline of this dominant party, that's when these churches that are already competing over their market share, they start to become really politically active. And that's when, Ian Paisley and his Free Presbyterian Church, during this time, they start establishing all of these political organizations. In 1966, they established what's called the Protestant Unionist Party. And it's a party that runs an election that's oriented specifically around protecting the Protestant heritage of Northern Ireland. And this is a huge, you know, sea change from the Unionist Party, the party of Terence O'Neill. That's this very secular, pro-union party that's just oriented around, relatively conservative economic policies, and that's their whole thing. So this dynamic, this sort of long-term trajectory starts with this huge resource crisis in the churches. Competition between these churches pushes them into politics when there's an opening. And the result is that when conflict heats up in the 1960s and throughout the 1970s, there are these mobilized religious actors that take an active role in conflict. And I should say they take an active role on both sides. It's not just that they get involved in promoting conflict, although a minority of them do. But they also, because they're politically active, they get involved in trying to find solutions to the conflict. But on the Protestant side, you end up with this politically motivated, very politically involved platform of religious leaders. So that's the dynamic on the Protestant side. And on the Catholic side, you have actually just exactly what I would predict. You have some resource shortages in the Catholic Church, in the same way that you have them in the Protestant Church, because these are broad macroeconomic processes that affect all sorts of civil society organizations. But the Catholic Church doesn't respond the same way. In general, the Church doesn't have anyone to compete with. It has a monopoly over the Catholic market, but also local priests really lack the autonomy to become politically or socially active in response to resource shortages. So, in effect, what you have is, as conflict between Protestants and Catholics ramps up, the Catholic organizations sometimes actually even appeal a little bit to the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church says, no, 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 we're not going to have anything to do with it. And there are a bunch of cases, a bunch of instances where, actually in, I can't remember what year it is, but in the 1970s, actually, the Pope visited Ireland and basically avoided all questions about the conflict. And Sinn Féin, who is the sort of one of the leading political parties representing Catholics, they reach out to the Pope and they say, you know, we want your stance on this conflict. Aren't we this aggrieved minority and we deserve representation and all this? And the Pope never even responds. He sort of just distances himself. And at the local level, the same thing happens. Priests basically avoid involvement with politics. Their official stance is that it's not right to take an active role in politics because when it becomes partisan, their jobs as priests are less effective. But when they do, in the small minority of cases where priests actually do become involved and they take a stance supporting the establishment of, or supporting the move of Northern Ireland to the Republic, or supporting the policies of Sinn Féin or even the IRA, they just sort of quietly get transferred from Northern Ireland to somewhere else by the church. So as a result, the dynamics on the Catholic side are almost entirely secular.
And I can see how this plays out. If you're a dominant church, if you're the hegemonic church and nobody can really go anywhere else, you don't want to get involved in political discussions too much, because that'll start dividing your church. And the one place that people could go is probably not to church. They would just exit the church entirely. So there's no strategic incentive for you to get involved in conflicts that might already be dividing your congregation. You take the high ground and say, you know, we're all Catholic, so let's just focus on the Catholic thing. Whereas in the Protestant case, I don't think there was anybody really sitting down saying, you know, if we talk about politics, we'll be able to get 15% more in the pews or anything. But you have congregations that are talking about this a lot, and you need to kind of talk about that too, relative to what everybody else is doing.
Well, that's right. The incentive there is to provide the supply that the demand wants.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just a totally different economic sort of situation on both sides of the divide there.
So let's move on to Sri Lanka and give us an idea of what's going on here in Sri Lanka, if you could.
As I said before, it's comparable in a lot of ways, but it's very different in a lot of ways. So obviously Northern Ireland has a history with British control and all this. I mean, it's currently part of the United Kingdom. And Sri Lanka also was a British colony, but the experience is really, really different, and it starts off from a very different place. So Sri Lanka gets independence from the British in 1948. It might have the award for longest colonial period. It was first colonized by the Portuguese in the 1600s, then it was taken over by the Dutch sometime in the 1700s, then it was taken over by the British in the 1800s. So fascinating history, and if anyone is interested in the history of religion and colonialism, it's just this really, really, really incredible case, because at first the Portuguese come in and they bring the Catholic Church and lots of missionaries and all of it. And then the Dutch come in and they bring the Dutch Reformed Church, but they have a totally different policy about local religion. And they have this sort of, you know, they stand off a bit and they give a little bit more breathing room to the local Buddhists and Hindus. And then the British come in, and they have, again, a totally different policy. And for a while, they're a little bit more forgiving. They start, they even provide a little bit of funding to local Buddhist organizations. But then around the 1870s, actually, there's a sort of mobilization of religious groups in the UK protesting against the concept of a British colonial regime providing funding to Buddhist organizations in Sri Lanka than Ceylon. So you end up with the British state sort of leaving in 1948 with this actual real material resource grievance by Buddhist organizations. When the British had taken over in 1815, it was under this agreement with the local with what had been the Sinhalese monarchy, and one of the parts of the agreement was, we, the British, will provide funding to the Buddhist monks. And then they abrogate that in the 1870s as a result of pressure back home. So in the 1940s, when Sri Lanka gets independence, there's a period of about, it's coming on the heels of about five decades of Buddhist monks really quite angry about not having the right, the sort of proper funding. But let me just say a little bit actually about how the Buddhist religious market sort of operates, because it's very different from maybe the sort of common understanding of how religious institutions work from a Christian perspective. So in Sri Lanka, the Buddhist authorities or the Buddhist sort of leaders are the monks, right? The Buddhist monks. And in Sri Lanka, I think there are about 38,000 monks today. So it's hard to get exact estimates of that, but somewhere around 38,000 monks distributed across about 10,000 temples on the island. And the monks all belong to these semi-hierarchical denominational type structures called Nikayas. But they're not really denominations in the sense that we might think, in the sort of, Christian or Jewish or Muslim sense of a denomination or sect. What they really are is they're almost like brotherhoods, based on procedural grounds. So if a monk is ordained a certain way, that puts him in the tradition of one of the Nikaya, right? And you might be ordained a different way, and that puts you in a different sort of tradition. But it's not really about, they're not really arguing about, you know, some specific aspect of their holy book that they disagree on. It's really just about, okay, I'm ordained in this certain lineage, or I perform my meditation in this certain way, and that puts me in this Nikaya. And they change. They change their Nikaya affiliation. Not all the time, but often. But the biggest, so that's one distinction. This is it's a denominational type structure, but it's not theological. It's a procedural distinction. Mm-hmm. But second, lay Buddhists, like non-monk Buddhists, don't really belong to these structures and don't really have a particular affiliation with them or any type of thing. So this, in a way, you can look at the Buddhist religious economy as being structured a little bit like the Protestant one in Northern Ireland, where you have a few different denominations that represent this ethnically bounded, religious market, right? But from another perspective, actually, it's a little bit different. They aren't hierarchical internally. Monks basically are just individuals. They have a temple affiliation, a local temple affiliation. They live at the temple. There's a hierarchy within each temple, but each temple functions basically as a self-contained entity, like a small business. But among the lay Buddhists, there isn't any sort of broader affiliation. They'll have a temple or multiple temples that they will visit and give alms to and all of that. But it's not the same as a single congregation like in Christianity. a lay Buddhist doesn't really belong to a single temple in the same way. They might go to one one day and another one a few days later. There aren't regular sermons in the same way that there are once a week in Christianity. The dynamic is a little bit more like the Buddhist monks are full-time religious people, and their job is to perform religion. And the laity, they participate by supporting the Buddhist monks and making sure that the Buddhist monks can perform religion. So in a way, it's less of a congregation adherent relationship, but it's actually also a little bit more clearly an economic relationship. The laity are providing material support so that the Buddhists can perform this public good. So with that dynamic sort of laid out, because the monks are dependent on the laity, it actually ends up operating politically in a very similar way to Northern Ireland, where you have Buddhist monks who become socially and politically active when they face material resource shortages. And I want to stress, it's not that they're acting in self-interested, profit-maximizing ways exactly. It's that they're dependent on the laity for support for, very modest, basically what you imagine the stereotypical Buddhist monk lifestyle is. It's still very, very commonly practiced in Sri Lanka. But when they don't have those things, they'll become politically active to get them back.
Yeah, you got to eat.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So starting in 1948, the dynamic is that Buddhist monks who enjoy a great deal of local autonomy but are dependent on the laity for material support end up becoming politically active whenever they're lacking this kind of support. And they start out at the beginning of the post-independence period in 1948 with, as I said, decades of lacking the proper support. So what they do is they just start forming political organizations once they're able to. But because you don't have this same kind of exclusivist dynamic where an individual has to belong to a specific temple, in the same way you have that for congregations in Christianity, the mobilization of the monks is actually very different. The effect is the same, but instead of forming competitive sort of organizations like the denominational competition in Northern Ireland, they end up forming these broad-based ad hoc coalitions of monks who pressure the state and pressure political parties, especially during elections, to adopt policies that favor the monks. And when they get those policies, and they're usually materially, there are material effects of those policies, like direct funding to Buddhist monks, they'll retreat from politics. So, in a way, it's a dynamic that has the same inputs and outputs as the dynamic in Northern Ireland and the things I found in my statistical analyses. But the pathway is very different, and it has a few different effects. So, whereas in Northern Ireland, the process is this creation of a political class of religious leaders who Withy and Paisley end up actually, Ian Paisley's party ends up becoming the dominant unionist party in Northern Ireland for decades. They're currently the largest party in Northern Ireland, although they don't have religious leadership anymore. In Sri Lanka, the dynamic is much more fluid. So you end up having a very considerable influence of religious actors in politics when the Buddhist monks are mobilized to get resources. But once they get them, they tend to leave quite rapidly. So they retreat from politics, they go back to, the regular sort of stereotypical Buddhist monk life, and they don't come back into politics unless their resources are threatened again. And so the effect of that on ethnic conflict is that when the resources are threatened, ethnic conflict becomes very religious. But once the Buddhist monks sort of effectively get what they want politically, they'll retreat from politics regardless of the circumstances going on with ethnic conflict, and ethnic conflict will shift to become a little bit more secular again.
Yeah. And then how does this play out in the civil conflict that occurs in the late 70s into the early 2000s?
So the post-independence period is basically it's basically characterized by these cycles where the Buddhist monks don't have the right resources. They mobilize. They form all these political organizations. They influence an election. A leader comes into power who's sympathetic to the monks, and then as a result of this dynamic, they end up getting the resources that they need, and then they end up retreating from politics. So it's a little bit it's a cycle that has this sort of natural input and output. And one of those cycles happens in the 1950s in Sri Lanka. And then another cycle starts in the end of the 1970s. And what's really fascinating is the late 1970s are this period in Sri Lanka where the economy is really going down the tubes. And it's a complicated process. It has a lot to do with their dependence on imports, broad global changes like the oil crisis in the 1970s, the cost of wheat changes dramatically in the 1970s. But there's also, within Sri Lanka, there are these dramatic changes in economic policy. There's this liberalization process that happened just at the wrong time. And in the early 1980s, Sri Lanka experiences a lot of GDP growth, but the prices of things skyrocket. And at the same time, state funding to Buddhism, which had been established in the 1950s under the first cycle of Buddhist mobilization, starts to hit the chopping block when the state is trying to figure out how to cut their budget. So you have this combined sort of decrease in support from the local laity because they can't afford it anymore. And then you also have a decline in state support to Buddhist monks because the state can't afford it anymore. So one of the effects of this economic crisis is that it pushes, as I said, Buddhist monks into politics. But the other effect of the economic crisis is that it exacerbates these latent tensions between the Sinhalese and the Tamils. And this is one of what I said several minutes ago, one of the first and clearest causes of ethnic conflict is when there's a systematic economic sort of disadvantage. And in general, poor economies are more likely to experience ethnic conflict. So this economic factor ends up in the 1970s and 1980s causing or contributing massively to the ethnic conflict, and also, for independent reasons, contributing to the mobilization of religious leaders. Mm-hmm. So right around the time when you have ethnic conflict really ramping up in the beginning of what will become the Civil War, you have Buddhist leaders getting involved, And that's why actually a lot of people have looked at this dynamic in Sri Lanka and said that Buddhists are responsible for conflict. But I think that they're just these different mirrored prophecies. And what happens is the Buddhist monks who are looking for these resources, they follow the pathway that of sort of least resistance, right? And as you said before, they look to meet the demand of the religious consumers. Mm-hmm. And there's a minority of religious consumers at this time who are really advocating for violence against Tamils, and a very small contingent of Buddhist monks become involved in that process. And they do so because it solves their resource problem. And at the same time, as I said, in Northern Ireland, there's also a contingent of monks who do just the opposite. They get politically involved and active in order to try to end this conflict. Mm-hmm. But their activism is caused by this same dynamic, that they're facing resource crises, and so they have to become active and raise their profile to get the state or the laity to support them again.
Well, that sounds like a very cool thesis, and we're going to be watching your dissertation as it progresses and eventually becomes a book, because I think this is one of the most fascinating topics that I've come across recently on ethnic conflict. I want to finish off with one final question here, and you're still pretty young in your career, but I would like you to do a little bit of reflection, and you've been working on this for a couple of years, and you've been thinking about ethnic conflict since kindergarten, I believe you said early on. Has the process of doing this dissertation and looking at these disparate countries and scenarios changed your mind about how you view the world, or has it sharpened things? Tell us a little bit of self-reflection here.
I wish I had more to say about this.
Well, you're young.
I do think something I said earlier about the generalizability of these dynamics across different religion is really, I think, it's something that I certainly might not have taken seriously before doing this research, and I think that in general a lot of people not only do they tacitly accept attitudes that some religions might be more violent or something like that, but I think they really actively adopt those attitudes even after reflection. And to me, this research has really consistently shown that that's just not the case, that as you said earlier, that all religious groups basically behave the same way, and some small minority of every religious group is going to use religion to promote violence. And generally, a much larger chunk of the same group is going to use religion to try and stop violence. And these are just universal dynamics that, even on the closest scrutiny, it's just the case that that's true everywhere. So I think that's my biggest takeaway so far.
Well, it is those universal dynamics that we try to tease out here on Research on Religion, finding commonalities across faith traditions, cultures, and periods of time throughout the world. And I want to thank Matthew Isaacs for being on Research on Religion. Matt, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.